This talk is, I think, I hope, all about beginning a little more discussion about local orbitals in maybe various senses and uses. So I'm going to talk about Wannier functions. And the ones that I will show you the figures of have all been made by Wei Ku. He's a postdoc in our group. He'll actually be here mid-September to mid-October. Helga Rosner is also a postdoc in our group. Richard Skeletar, colleague. And a little bit of work that I probably won't get to, Michelle Johannes. I just looked her up, but she's not here right now. So first of all, some very general comments about Wannier functions, which might be the most useful part of this for some of you. A little bit about how these are calculated that I'll show you, the application to these fairly complex, structurally complex magnetic insulators. Then just show you some pictures for cerium. It's very recent stuff. We haven't done anything with these Wannier functions in cerium. And probably won't get to this CCTO unless by popular demand. So, about local orbitals. The first question, what do you want them for? You want them as just another basis set? We heard Gabby talking this morning, or this afternoon, I guess it was, that a lot of what's really interesting these days has to do with electrons that aren't really described by plane wave or itinerant like basis sets. So that's fine. If you just want another basis set, that's possibly a good enough reason. Some physical meaning, that's certainly good. LDA plus U methods, DMFT, this orbital that has this U associated with it, we believe it has some physical meaning in some sense. Just how to define that is anybody's task. Orthogonal functions, orthogonal on different sites. Well, generally they're easier to work with in many respects. A cost in localization. Probably Rolly will say something about this when he talks about local orbitals. Maximally localized orbitals, Wannier functions. This is something that David Vanderbilt has resurrected in the past 5 years or so. And one question is there any physics in having maximally localized Wannier functions, or is it, numerically it might be more efficient. In many cases can be more efficient. Do you want them specific symmetries? So forth. Okay, this figure at the bottom is just taking up space at the moment. I'll come back to that briefly after the next few wrap, I guess. So some generalities about Wannier functions. So given an isolated set of bands with block wave functions, which are itinerant, Wannier functions are given by this kind of sum over K wave vector, sum over band index here, a unitary matrix U like this, give you Wannier functions. U of K is any unitary transformation. So these are not at all unique. R just labels the unit cell here, and the orbital within the unit cell is this index M. It can be on different atoms in general. Now, for a single band, this U reduces just to a phase factor. It's a one by one unitary matrix, a phase factor, and it affects the localization. And that's what I was showing with a very toy model, as we used the term in the previous view graph. You just look at single one-dimensional plane wave, free electron system, and look at the band that goes up just to the zone boundary, and the Wannier function you get, if you use that formula with that phase factor equal to 1, is just sine x over x, which is this pink line, red line here. And I just put in a little phase factor and did the sum phase factor, which is an e to the I alpha k squared. You can see it shifts things, it changes here, and it changes nodes and so forth. It makes some changes. But that's unrealistic kind of picture to be thinking in terms of. Okay, if the block wave functions are orthonormal, which they are, then you do this transformation, you get orthonormal 1A functions right here. And this unitary transformation provides, in general, much flexibility. You can have maximally localized 1A functions, or you can do other things, perhaps. So, let's start, continue the generalities, but single band. Given a single band, what can we say about the single 1A function? So here's our single band, our one electron Hamiltonian. And E of K is Fourier transform of our Hopping parameters. And these things are unique. It's just a Fourier transform of this, which is given. Fourier transform is unique. All these Fourier components are distinct. So these Hopping parameters are unique. Hence the extent, to some sense, how far they reach, how far electrons in those states can hop, is determined. That's unique. However, if you just go back and look at that transformation, the density of 1A state does depend on the phase factor, or its extent does depend on the phase choice to some extent. Mm-hmm. But it's to some limited sort of extent because the hoppings are unique, right? So this is something really maybe for further research. But if you think about a simple, say, spin half orbital, so you have a simple system, and that's what we'll be looking at for the main example I show you. The degree of localization is somewhat flexible, but the hopping range and hopping parameters are not if you have a single band. Now for multi-band systems,
it's obvious to everybody here, of course, but I mean the statement, the hopping integrals are the matrix elements of the Hamiltonian in the Van Allen.
Right.
It's clear that.
Right. Yeah. You'll see that on maybe the next few graphs. So for multi-band systems, progressively less can be said in general about these 1A functions. However, it seems to me fairly clear that still the Fourier components that are included in this epsilon of K, even if it's a complex of bands, so you have to diagonalize the matrix to get the answer, the Fourier components that are included are sort of fixed in here, and to some extent there may not be a lot of flexibility about how to adjust the hopping integrals. Okay. Symmetric projection of 1A functions. So this is actually what we're doing right now, what Wei Ku is doing. Given an isolated set of block bands, we'll start with an isolated set. Choose symmetry-related orbitals of some sort. Whatever they are, put the same number of these as there are these. Form these projections right here. Call that matrix M. Then if you construct this unitary transformation, this M times that thing, which is unitary, demonstrated here, you transform to 1A functions, then you get symmetric 1A functions if these G are symmetric. Well, if this isolated set of bands, you know, I'm assuming the symmetry of these is sort of consistent with the symmetry of the atomic states that make up these bands, that are the primary components of these bands. All right. And this transformation, and in general not just, well, this general transformation, even for multiband systems, conserves the density of the subspace. So all the density from the block states is equal to all the density from the 1A states. So the 1A states give you just a different way of decomposing the density.
There is still an arbitrary phase factor in there, right?
In where?
Like from the psi. Psi has an arbitrary phase factor right on the top, the first line.
Right.
So, it can so therefore your aim has an arbitrary phase factor.
There's an arbitrary, there's an overall phase factor here if you want.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, so this question of phase factors we haven't looked into yet.
Where's the index J? In transformation to running wave functions?
The J?
J and so J should be also on W, no?
Yes. So I've left off all the indices here.
So, so there's J. Are labeled by the J.
They're labeled by a J, right. A J, a position, and an orbital index on that position.
I thought J is the orbital index. Then I'm misunderstood.
Yes. This is the site. This is the site, and the J, which will show up on the next view graph, or like here, M, that's the orbital index.
Okay, so you have as many J's as you have N's.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Possibly one could think about generalizing. We certainly haven't got into that.
Localized.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
So, yeah, we choose something that actually simpler than even an atomic orbital, but atomic orbital would be the simplest, most transparent choice. Okay, so applications, or at least the applications I'm going to talk about. Given this set, which has orbital index and a site index in general, the site energy that I will be discussing here is just this, one electron Hamiltonian here. This is this hopping integral that Ole referred to. It's given specifically by this integral from J to I. This is U. This is a Coulomb. If these indices are the same, it's sort of Coulomb self-interaction. But you can also consider off-diagonal interactions of one orbital with another on the same site. You could even do it on different sites, generalize it to different sites if you want to consider that. That's a bare thing. This is, right now, this is unscreened Coulomb interaction. And I'm writing this down because we're also going to consider this. This is the exchange constant. Which can be between different sites also, between orbital I on site R and orbital J at the origin.
Absolutely.
And you can calculate lots of other quantities if you want.
But in principle, it's four indices, yeah? Because it's...
Yeah, there are even the four indices. For the full many-body Hamiltonian with two-body interactions, there's a general four indices,
four.
Right. Four indices, four sites. Yeah.
General matrix elements of Coulomb interaction.
So just as a preview, I'll show you something for silicon. Now this is not what we usually do. This is the maximally localized according to Vanderbilt's prescription. Well, we haven't fully implemented his, but the picture looks the same. For silicon, if you just take the valence bands, the four valence bands, and use those, then you get four bond-centered orbitals like this. And they are considerably more localized than sp3 type orbitals, which would have a blob sticking out here and three little blobs behind. Here's a silicon site right here and a silicon site right there, okay? Inside this primitive cell. So this is just different values of the density of this orbital, the orbital density. That really shows you the shape and the positions of the silicons. And as you lower the density,
you can see more details. We'll look at some of those details for this example of lanthanum barium copper oxide material.
Well, did you look at the how this decays down exponentially or something at the functional distance?
No. And well, you'll sort of see why when we look at what we really want, have been wanting to look at so far. So this is the beginning of what I'm going to discuss about this compound. And this is actually going to appear in PhysRev letters in the next month or so. Basically what I'm telling you here. So what about this compound? This is a ferromagnetic insulator. And there really aren't a lot of ferromagnetic insulators. This is one. In fact, when high TCs were discovered by Bednarz and Mueller and lanthanum barium copper oxide, they didn't have single-phase samples. Other people produced them fairly quickly. But people that were making these had two main other phases in the material. One was the green phase, which is anti-ferromagnetic, and the brown phase. That's this phase, and it took actually a few years, I think, to 3 or 4 years to isolate this well. It's ferromagnetic insulator. These things are standard. So this one is ferromagnetic. But you can put neodymium there. In fact, you can put most or all of the rare earths there on that site. And it's anti-ferromagnetic.
Structure changes or?
Structure is the same.
Same.
Structurally identical. Neodymium is a smaller ion, so the lattice constant is about 2% less. But that's part of the big question. What's the difference? What's the underlying microscopic difference that gives you ferromagnetism in one case and anti-ferromagnetism in another? Okay. Let me go to the next few graphs, which is still not the best figure, but it gives a top view as well. The problem with this figure is that it doesn't show you complete copper oxygen squares, which will on later view graphs will be shown. But here's the copper, here's two oxygens, and the other two are sticking outside this. It's not cube, it's a tetragonal material, so A and A and C, and you have a copper oxygen 4 square like this, and another one like this in the unit cell. The top view shows you, here's copper, oxygen, oxygen. There's another oxygen straight below that. So here's a copper oxygen square, and here's a copper oxygen square. That makes up the unit cell. Sorry, here. And here. Again, later figures will.
There are no copper oxygen sheets.
No. These are isolated squares. No sharing edges, no sharing corners. It's isolated, so this one's right here. This one goes from here to here. That one from there to there. And, in fact, if you look here, you go copper, oxygen. It's almost straight to a lanthanum. And after all, the difference between these two materials is a lanthanum versus neodymium. One is ferromagnetic.
If you're comparing to the ICCs, oxygen,
no, this is the planar oxygen right here. These have four planar oxygens.
Yeah. They are terminated with a rare earth.
Well, then, I don't know. There's a rare earth sitting over here, which is more or less, not exactly, but more or less in a straight line. Okay, and this is the size of the unit cell. There's two copper atoms and two copper spins in the system. You'll see the structure a little bit more clearly in a moment. Now,
say it's a ferromagnetic. I mean,
it's ferromagnetic.
What's the moment? I mean,
well, the moment it's a ferromagnetic insulator. The moment is one spin 1/2 moment per copper. So since there's two in the unit cell, I guess it's two Bohr magnetons per unit cell, but it's one. And I will say shortly how that moment is distributed according to our calculations. Now, the magnetic coupling in this material has been addressed by Feldkamper and Weber, Werner Weber, a few years ago. And what they did was a real sort of tour de force, state-of-the-art study using, and you have to include the lanthanum because lanthanum versus neodymium, that's one of the questions, copper d orbitals, oxygen p orbitals, lanthanum d orbitals. The barium is out of the picture, just the ion. So you have several parameters. On-site energies of all those, hoppings, and so forth. So there are a lot of parameters. Well, they fixed most of their parameters based on what was known about some other cuprates, not necessarily very structurally similar to these, and varied a couple of other parameters, like lanthanum-oxygen coupling and so forth. And they found a narrow parameter range where you could get ferromagnetic coupling once you did all this cluster calculations, which is equivalent to sixth order and eighth order perturbation theory in these hoppings compared to the U on the copper or the on-site energy differences and so forth. Now, what I'm going to be describing here is looking at this spin coupling in a different way, just using a single orbital 1A function on each of the coppers. So that's two per unit cell since there's two coppers. And all of this hybridization of copper to oxygen to lanthanum to wherever is done just by LDA and then 1A transformation. And then calculating some things. Okay. You had to see one messy view graph, right? Don't there are not much of the details here you have to really pay attention to. What we're pointing out here is when you reformulate the full many-body Hamiltonian in terms of localized orbitals, and in addition, in terms of some density functional related quantities, such as the density, which is exact in principle. And so this n wiggle is the density operator for this orbital on this site, they're both in this index here, minus the density, the DFT constant value of that, which is actually the ground state value. And also these things with the wiggle, also this is this minus their density functional expectation value. Okay, the point is here, what we're going to deal with, we don't have to worry about this because it's such a simple system. They're all the same. The hopping parameters, the Coulomb interaction, and when you reformulate all this, you can write it in the terms of a Heisenberg-like coupling of spins between atoms, not only on the same site, but on opposite sites. But this is a direct exchange interaction, not a super exchange interaction. This is a direct exchange interaction like this. Just the usual form you see in chemistry books, except this also includes the possibility that this nu is on a different site than the mu.
What?
Yes.
At this stage, the U is still the bare.
This is bare. Yes.
Won't you have the little substructures of the density functional theory?
That's right. And what I'm going to show you here, we're still discussing in our group the best way to sort of tackle some bigger issues than what we've done so far. So what I'm going to show you is just on-site energy, actually not for this material, but for cerium, I hope I'll get to. Just the usual on-site quantity. This is just pointing out that you have some terms in the DFT Hamiltonian, which corresponds to self-interaction, which Wei has reasons for wanting to think from that point of view, and also for hopping parameters, what we normally think of is just the matrix element of this. One might want to formulate that a little differently. This is the bare Coulomb interaction, the Bayer exchange interaction, and, okay, spin independent basis set.
But how much, and how big are those terms? I mean, normally people would just take HDFT between mu
right.
and mu.
Well, that's the point. This is perhaps depends on just what the expectation value in this state is, but this is not a tiny term.
It's not.
Of course, this is not a tiny term. Right. So it's you know, there's going to be other terms elsewhere which change also by substantial
right.
amounts. So it's of some importance to formulate it in whatever the best way is. And
right.
we're
but
not.
Can you give us some rationale why this
what
is a good way?
So we're not using this right now. I'm just using this view graph to illustrate when you transform the Hamiltonian, you get terms, specifically this direct exchange interaction between intersite interaction as well as on-site. The on-site is common from quantum chemistry, from atomic physics. Okay, but the rest of this, let's not worry about. I'm using just the simpler, the usual quantities in what I show you. So, the band structure of these things. At the upper left is just this transformation, which looks a lot more complicated than it did in the early view graph, but it's the same thing. So, here is the lanthanum 422 band structure, paramagnetic band structure. Here's the neodymium 422. Very little dispersion. These are, after all, completely. Well, not completely. They're isolated copper oxygen spheres, squares, not sharing any corners even. So the dispersion is very small, and it's different in the neodymium. And it's, I think, no doubt some importance that we're using all electron full potential Wien code to calculate the band structure, to calculate the 1A functions, so forth.
So Warren, just to make sure I understand, what is plotted here is the average value of H and EA.
No, this is just right here.
These are just the band.
This is just the paramagnetic band structure.
Oh,
okay. So let's say where's the Fermi level? It's right in here because these two bands are half filled. They're two bands because they're two coppers per unit cell. And so in transforming to 1A functions, you have to take into account the two copper per unit cell. You have to project the states onto copper DXY-like functions. And that's what we do, and that's what I want to show you. So a few pictures now. Well, this is what you always thought copper D states look like, right? So if you look at a high enough density, you see just, you'll see why the box is so big here. But that's what
but
you
these bands are what they were, 50 millivolts broad or what?
Yeah. Yeah.
Extremely what, narrow.
Extremely narrow.
For band.
That's right. This one, you know, the neodymium is maybe two or three times as.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So, if you really look at these functions, here's what you see. Okay? So now, this is a unit cell up here. So this box actually contains 8 of these unit cells. But what we're showing now, this is the 1A function. So here's the copper DXY part. We know it's hybridized with the oxygens here, 4 oxygens on either side. You can see that it's antibonding. There's a node between the D and the P. And then over here, this is the lanthanum. And you see the lanthanum, it's got this little ring here. That's a combination of D states, which is much larger on this side of the D atom than on that one. And so that's showing the 1A function on this copper, on this copper. This is where it sits. And these various integrals involve this function times this function, times, say, the one electron Hamiltonian to get the hopping parameters, or function squared to get the U, whatever. Okay? And so that's just nearest neighbors. But then what we find is that although the band structure looks innocuous. It's not so very simple to represent in terms of hopping. But first of all, let me just say something about these 1EA functions. There's about 50% of the density on the copper, about 10% on each of the four oxygens, and then roughly 2% on each of the four lanthanums, each connected to one of the oxygens, something like that. So that's where the charge lies. And by the way, there's a hyperfine field seen on the lanthanum, which the experimentalists call large. I forget whether it's 2 tesla or 4 or 8 tesla or something like that, but there's a large hyperfine field on the lanthanum, which means that there's indeed a very noticeable spin density in this ferromagnetic insulator on the lanthanum and at the lanthanum nucleus. So there has to be charge from this 1EA state there. Okay. These hopping parameters, I'll show you the values. They're calculated from this expression I showed you, not fitted. A good fit would get you the same result. These U and J quantities are evaluated from 6D numerical integration, although not exactly fully. I have to say that it's just all the contributions within all the spheres are what's included here. And that should get 95-98% of the contributions, I think. But just all the quantities within all the spheres.
Yeah.
But the interstitial region has not been taken care of. Right. Now, as someone mentioned, the U we're calculating is bare.
So typically, what's the order of magnitude that you're
getting? I'll show you on the next D graph. And we know you shouldn't use a bare U. What we do in these super exchange estimates is to divide it by 2. Okay? We don't. that's a number most often used in the literature, I would say. No, there's.
Why not?
But it's probably the right order of magnitude, but we don't. Really don't know.
But the order of magnitude is t squared over u, right? No matter what you do. Yeah. I mean, the question is, what is the free factor?
It's what you put in for u here. Yeah. That should be the screened u. We're calculating the unscreened u. So we're calling the screened uw here, and we're approximating it by the unscreened value divided by 2.
Okay.
And I'll show you what the unscreened value is.
So these ui's are calculated for the linear functions, right?
Yes.
But since the value of functions are not so well defined, depending on how you cut over the functions, so you will be
different. Yes, we have.
In this case, you minimize the value of R squared. If I had minimized the value of R cubed, I would have gotten something else. Right?
Mm-hmm. Let me.
So in any case, we're dividing by 2 or something. It's not very.
We didn't actually minimize anything. We haven't really implemented the Vanderbilt. We've implemented sort of the projection type of procedure that he incorporated, but not the further procedures. But let me just point out that here, you've got in your block functions for these bands, you've got a certain amount of density on the lanthanum. And that density has to be in the 1EA function. Okay, we have 2 identical 1EA functions in the unit cell. Actually, a lanthanum is connected, I believe, to 4, like this, 4 neighboring coppers. But anyway, there's the density on the lanthanum in the block functions has to occur in the 1EA functions. You're never going to be able to localize this and get rid of this density. In fact, the amount of the density and the form of the density, it could, in principle, be shifted around a little bit from 1EA function to 1EA function, but not much. Okay? So you can't localize it and get rid of this contribution.
Sorry, Juan, did you say the lanthanum, is that shared between 2 Vanier orbitals, or is it, or maybe this picture down to the right will explain it.
It's,
I don't understand the connectivity.
Okay, yeah. Well, I don't know. Let's look up here.
What is the hopping integral? I mean,
here's a lanthanum.
How does the T's work? There must be some dominating T's. They help you from one manual function to the other. How is that connected?
Well, okay, let's go ahead. Let's go ahead and... You want numbers? We've got numbers. We've got numbers, numbers with the picture. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. So, first question, the bare U for this Wannier function is 7.5 eV. And if you think of a bare U for a copper D function being maybe 25 or 30 eV, and you only have half the density, half the charge of this Wannier function on the copper, and that occurs twice in your equation for U, then you would expect roughly 1/4 this U if you can neglect all the other contributions, which are certainly small compared to this, roughly 1/4 of the bare atomic value, which is what the scale is. So this is the bare value for this Wannier function. And then when I quote the super exchange numbers here, we're going to divide this by 2 to use the denominator. So here are the calculated T.
Feeling for how much this number depends on the choice of the Wannier function?
I think it's got to depend very little, actually. You've got to have, I mean, the Wannier function has to go out and include that lanthanum. So it's extended that far. Really, if it's going to exchange charge very much between copper, it's got to be copper and oxygen. But I don't think you can exchange, well, I know you can't exchange that much because each of these oxygens just belongs to one copper in the Wannier function.
But I can always make a Wannier function which is maximally delocalized.
Well, I don't know if there's any maximally delocalization or not. I haven't heard of such a principle. But see, this oxygen,
the block state.
This oxygen right here belongs to this copper and no other copper. And this Wannier function, okay, this is oxygen states.
No, that's not, I mean...
These are oxygen states. So,
I mean, the Wannier function has this property that the quantum number, I mean, it has one function here, and the other function on the basis state is just that you translate R by a lattice constant. That is different than many other functions. Yeah. So you just have one shape. And it always looks the same. This is the shape of the Wannier function. You put it here, you put it there, you put it there, and that gives you a yield space. That's not that property block functions.
True, but can one make something that approaches the copper? The question is how arbitrary is the localization of that? Can one make something which approaches the, which gets larger and larger?
Can make anything.
You can make a different linear combination.
Right.
And that's why maybe Warren should say once again, you said that
you might,
but maybe you didn't understand it, how you just directly constructed some Wannier functions which are natural for your basis set to construct.
Right.
And that's where the localization comes from. You had some stupid basis set, it wouldn't be so localized.
And we projected them onto reasonable functions.
Yes, it's a specific.
Okay, if you project them, you know, we're really projecting them out based on their copper D character. If we'd chosen them based on their oxygen 5s character or something.
To mix these things, you will, let's say you start off with Warren's Wannier function, and then you make some linear combinations of those in the other states, and then you can get the same factor. And you have to keep them orthogonal and so on. But that would mean that the Wannier function would sit on more than one, say, cover. Cover is a central one. So you have this cover x squared minus y squared. And in the pictures we saw, it was all sitting on one plaquette or one of those.
Right.
And the only thing. And if you did something unreasonable, it would also sit on the neighboring copper or some other copper, but apparently he hasn't gotten that. Where the question can then be if there's some shared atom, I don't know whether these lanthanums are shared, then...
These lanthanums are shared. Okay, so here are calculated T's. And these...
That's a question, Warren. Okay. Whether the localization has anything to do with the bandwidth.
Because the bands are very narrow.
Yes.
So you cannot get a very delocalized...
I think that's correct.
So the thing is now that these the bandwidth is given by the hopping intervals, and we said that the hopping intervals were given because they are the same no matter how you choose your bandwidth.
For these single band systems, right?
Single band system, yes. But I think I intuitively believe that the more narrow the band is, you have a millivolt broadband and volts, gaps and volts around it. So it's almost like an atomic level.
There
is no freedom really in this localization system.
It's the width of the band compared to the gap that they're in here. Mm-hmm. And that's controlling how much lanthanum is mixed in, how much oxygen P is mixed in. Right. So that's this is probably a pretty well-defined 1E function, this system. So we can just straightforwardly calculate these hopping parameters. So taking one of your coppers to be at the origin, and the one along the z-axis here, and along the 111 direction, and so forth. OK, you see some of these are zero by symmetry, because the structure has quite a bit of symmetry in it.
These are millielectron volts?
These are millielectron volts, right. Uh-huh. Now, and here are the direct exchange. This is between a copper 1EA function at the origin and one along the z-axis. You go further away from that, it's negligible. Here is in the 101 direction, like this, there, and then here, just hopping parameters denoted. So if you picture all this, the main hopping parameters are given by these blue arrows. And it's not just nearest neighbor stuff. In fact, the nearest neighbor stuff, zero here, and this is second neighbor here is zero. So,
okay.
Well, here's the nearest neighbor, and you could also think about in the plane, the distance
zero,
is not exactly the same, but this is zero by symmetry,
yeah.
But not this. And this is of some importance, actually not in this compound. It's overwhelmed in this compound. But here is a hopping parameter from this one over to that corner, 4.8. This one over to here, 3.6. This one to here, which of course would be the same as this one to there, 8.8 millivolts. Those are the big ones. But in this compound, it's the direct exchange. Here, you have to multiply these by numbers of neighbors and so forth, and we're not constructing really an effective Heisenberg model yet. The parameters are not well enough known. But you have strong direct exchange, ferromagnetic sign always, here between neighboring atoms. And then within the plane, you don't have a ferromagnetic interaction. You don't have a primary ferromagnetic interaction. This one's actually zero. But the reason, based on these parameters, this is ferromagnetic, is that first of all, you have a strong ferromagnetic coupling here along the z-axis, and then also a strong ferromagnetic coupling between this atom and one the layer down, and by tetragonal symmetry, also over there, the same. So it's this coupling that makes things align in the plane and not coupling within the plane. Yes.
Let me make sure I understand exactly what's going on. So basically, with these very, very localized, using these Vanier functions, the overlaps, the TIJs you are getting at on the scale of a few millivolts, right?
Right.
On the other hand, you are computing Coulomb matrix elements with just the bare thing,
mm-hmm.
and that gives you numbers which are on the scale of 8 dB, but I would have expected more, actually. You're fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the result.
Would it be reasonable to expect somewhat bigger numbers of the order of R3?
For the U?
Yeah.
If it were just an atom, so you're talking about a wave function, which is spread out not only on the copper, but on the four oxygens, plus somewhat on the lanthanum, and it's normalized, it's normalized over all this,
okay,
not just on the copper.
I see. So that's why it's not 25 dB.
That's right.
Okay. but rather like ATV.
That's right.
Then when you compute the JIJs, you compute the JIJs are matrix element of the still the bare Coulomb interaction.
That's right.
Into these orbitals that are very, very, have very, these very, very tiny bandwidth, right? And this is how you get a number which is on the scale of half an EV or whatever, 0.1 EV, because basically there is a compensation between two effects, the fact that you have these very big numbers in the Coulomb interaction and the fact that the overlap is very, very small from one side to the next, right? This is more or less how this works.
Yes, the super exchange interaction is small because the T's are small, the order of just a few millivolts, and it's 4T squared over U.
No, but if I was doing 4T squared over U with T of order 3 MeV.
Divided by 1, how can you get such big K's?
Yeah, that's exactly my point. I'm trying to understand. Exactly. I'm trying to understand qualitatively. I mean, you show us T's of order 3 MeV.
It's
ATV. So if I do 4T over U, no way I'm getting to
10 to the minus 5.
Right, exactly. So that's not what you are doing. You are computing the matrix elements you were showing us before, right? But they are not of order T squared over U at all.
No, the J's listed here, super exchange.
Yeah.
And I think actually number of nearest neighbors are taken into account here. This is like the largest.
We have a discrepancy of order of
100. But that, exactly, that can never be T squared over U, come on.
No, U is 4. So 4T squared over U is just T squared. Right?
Yeah, but this is T squared.
And, okay, the largest T is 9 in this case. So,
MeV.
I think MeV. I think it works out fine. Anyway, I can tell you, find out specifically what we've done.
But it's not calculated that way in practice, right? I mean, this is calculated as the matrix elements you have.
No, the super exchange is minus 4 T squared over U times number of neighbors, I think, goes into this number here.
Or do you calculate it that way, or do you calculate
yes.
the four-center overlap integral?
No, not a super exchange. The J is the double integral. That's the exchange. This is the real, the direct exchange.
Oh, I see.
Is this exchange integral.
I see.
But the super exchange is just 4 T squared over U.
Okay. But then I don't understand this number.
So the J is, say, the upper one is minus 0.1 millivolt.
Yes, right.
Minus 0.1 millivolt.
Right.
Right.
That's the largest super exchange, and I think there's even
a factor. No, but confusing is that probably people just use an EV, not MeV.
Minus 0.1 millivolt. Yeah, that fits.
So the TC of this is 5 degrees, and the antiferromagnet's about 7.5 or 8 degrees.
I see.
So let me just show you the numbers for the neodymium compound.
So the message is that one just can evaluate the use by simply computing matrix elements in Vanier wave functions.
Well, you can evaluate them, but they're bare use, so, you know, we divide by 2 and wave our hands for that. But so if it comes out to be a close call, as it's doing in some other compounds we're looking at, we can't.
Oh, I see. So the factor of 2 is not from the formula from super exchange. It's just to take into account some screening.
Screening, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So this compound is very close to the atomic limit in a many-body physicist lab.
Well,
that's what you're telling us.
Well, no, the screening is 2.
I don't know.
2, so it's not so close.
So let's just look at
That's a nasty.
No, I mean, it's not, if it was atomic, then.
But the bandwidth is 3 MeV and U is 8 MeV, so it's that close to the atomic limit. I'm sorry.
I don't know, is it close to the atomic? Only half of the charge, the 1EA function, is on the copper. The other half is on other atoms.
Well, what I'm trying to say is that you're telling me T is 3 MeV, right? Or 9 MeV.
Mm-hmm.
And
TIJ. Yes, the largest T in that other case.
U is on the scale of 6, 7 EV.
It was 7. Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's
we divide it by 2, so it's 4.
That's what.
Now it's a molecule.
A molecule. Fine.
Yeah.
I grant you a molecule.
That's right. It's a molecule. Okay. So weakly overlapping molecule. So this is the neodymium system, and the difference you could see in the dispersion of the bands really shows up with a very large compared to all those others, hopping parameters along the z-axis. Here, And now when you take t squared over 4t squared over u and number of neighbors, which is just 2 here, I guess, the super exchange comes out to be around this, anti-ferromagnetic, and the direct exchange, which and along the same, is our estimate half as much. So it's plausible that super exchange wins here. These are anti-aligned, which we've drawn here as brown and blue, but there's still this strong, relatively strong, direct exchange that aligns this spin and this spin. So that has the effect, this one anti-aligned with that, aligned with that, anti-aligns these in the plane, and you get the anti-ferromagnetic structure from these two prominent interactions. And again, the other, the dominant hopping interactions other than this one, and then 8 and 8, okay? And U, there's a surprising amount of difference for the U here. And that's primarily a volume effect, but compressing the volume by 6% is 2% in the lattice constant. Changes the amount of charge on the copper noticeably. I don't know exactly the number, but it changes the U from 7.5 to 6.1.
So the copper oxygen distance is
that. The copper, I can't remember for sure. Good question.
So the Van der Waals functions in this case, in some sense, are more delocalized, right?
That's right.
Well, that's what
right. Mm-hmm. And they're different. You can't see the difference in delocalization here. But here, if you just look at one of those legs, you already saw this one, the ring of B charge around the lanthanum. So here's the copper, the oxygen, the lanthanum, a little bit of another oxygen. On the neodymium, this is what it looks like. And actually, in one of the integrals, in the exchange integral, in the hopping integral along the z-axis, that one which is large, 30, a significant amount of the integral comes from this oxygen. So the neighboring one-E function down here, the oxygen density would look like this. It would be located here. And that one-E function would have these blobs on this. But a significant amount of the integral comes from the oxygen here because of this little bit, as well as from the neodymium here. Now, we wanted to see if this was just the lattice constant effect. It was just difference, of course, the density looks different here than here. So we compressed the lanthanum compound to have the same lattice constants as the neodymium. You can't see any change in how the 1EA function looks. And moreover, it's the numbers haven't changed to lead to anti-ferromagnetism. However, they're moving. There are some changes moving in that direction, so we expect there will be a ferromagnetic to anti-ferromagnetic transition under more pressure, but not for the same reason that the coupling is anti-ferromagnetic there, not the same exchange coupling constants.
Do they depend on the size of the spheres that you're using?
No, these.
Only inside the spheres.
Okay, those numbers would change a little bit if we change the sphere sizes. I don't know. If we changed them as much as one reasonably could, they might change by 5% or a little more than that. So it'd be better if we could, it's possible to do the inner, it's just a little messy.
Yeah.
So let me skip to, there's a summarizing view graph. I think we've spent enough on that. Let me.
Can I ask one?
Yeah.
So as to the chemistry or physics of this, I mean, isn't it always that, is it simply that as you go through the rare earth series, of course, you fill up the F shell and you get more nuclear charge than the usual thing, so the 5D on-site energy will fall. 5D is much higher in lanthanum than it is in neodymium. So therefore, the neodymium 5D are more polarizable than the lanthanum ones, and therefore you get more little charge out on this 5D their site, and it is via that site that you hop along to the next neighbor, and that's why this tea
grows. It probably is, it's definitely a chemical difference, and it's probably that chemical difference. By the way, I didn't tell you, but we did LDA plus U on the F states here to get the F states away from the Fermi energy. We wouldn't be able to do any of this if you just used LDA, because the partially filled neodymium F shell would sit right at the Fermi level. So that has to be done. That was extra chore. So let me just...
You can put the U on the copper, only on the neodymium. In the LDA plus U calculation?
Yes.
Okay.
Only, it was paramagnetic copper, right. Okay, let me just tell you a little bit about cerium, and not going to say anything about the physics of cerium. Most of you know some of why cerium is interesting. It there are still a few different viewpoints on what exactly is happening in cerium under pressure, where there's a volume collapse as you lower the temperature, or the other way around as you raise the temperature, some kind of electronic structure instability relating to the F function and its interaction with the environment. But this is just going to be...
Mike's little point of view.
I'm not taking a point of view here. This is just art. Right now it's no physics related to that transition. I just want to talk about 1EA functions when you don't have a set of isolated bands. So this is a broad view of the cerium band structure at either the alpha or gamma volumes. It doesn't matter here. This is 5s, 5p, 4f states right in here. With one, this is paramagnetic, one f electron occupied. The 5d goes through, in fact, okay. This is S fat bands, this is P fat bands, the rest of this. So 5Ds are sitting up here from, I think this is mostly D-like down here, up several EV, and then 6S and 6P lie up here somewhere. And Wei has calculated these. Now it's very simple to calculate the 1EA functions here and 1EA functions here. I'll show you what they are, but they're simple, no surprises. But to calculate the F functions here, what he does is to project these onto the related symmetry type of, it's not an atomic orbital, it could have been, it's just sort of Gaussian blobs centered in the places where 5F orbitals would have their density. And picking out seven states at each K point with the maximum amount of F character. And then once those Fs have been calculated, then he calculates the 5Ds, and then also 6Ss and 6Ps. This is very new stuff, so I just want to show you that maybe this is a useful procedure. So here is 5S and 5P. No surprises here. These dots are just the centers of neighboring ceriums. There's a little nuclear peak there. And this is one of the F functions. This is the on-site energy of the 5S, 5P, again way down where we don't worry about them. This is the one F function, which is its own in cubic symmetry. Its on-site energy is 0.9 EV, and it looks like that. If you go to, so this is a density of 0.001. You decrease the density by a factor of 5, where you plot the isosurface, you begin to see that this F function is latching on, has a little bit of some neighboring functions. And I can't tell you right now what part of that is D and what part is F. But let's look at the other F functions. Again, here's a relatively large value of the density, and they're just what F functions should look like. And then if you lower the density to see how they're interacting, coupling to the neighboring cerium atoms, you see these Fs that are the 5x squared minus 3x form, just coupled to the cerium neighboring. And I think that's probably an S blob, but I don't know that for certain. And here, these that point off toward the, all the nearest neighbors have this connection with all the nearest neighbors.
So how many bands do you select near the Fermi level to generate your Van Leeuwen functions?
So these he selected 7 bands to get the 7F functions. Now, in principle, and maybe in practice it would be useful, you could do this all at once. You could not choose separately 5F, 4F, 5D, and then 6S and 6P if you want to include those. But you could, so he's sort of chopping these out a set at a time. The normalization comes out automatically, the normalization to 1.
The 5F bands have also a lot of S and D character, no?
Well, they don't have, well, let's look. So here's 5D. So these, the bottom part of the 5D bands go through the cerium F bands. Here's the
I'm just trying to understand. You start with some bands, and you have to decide, this one I project on Fs, and this one I project on Ds, and these I project on S. How do you tell?
You get some grids.
The amount of character.
Some character of the function, but the rest is, as you say, less.
So you do some sort of fat bands, and you decide by basically how strong the color, which one it is.
Or if and you have more bands, so you could do it by symmetry.
And
by symmetry?
Yeah. Look at what kind of bands the symmetry points F would span at that particular K point, and look at that symmetry and go to
I know what I'm doing, but I like to, I mean, this is maybe everybody knows what he's doing, but I mean, what is unique about this?
So
in this case, you have overlapping hybridizing bands.
Yes.
So there are no isolated bands. Even if you could find one, there might, of course, be one. Then you wouldn't like the Van Leeuwen function for it, because it would be very hybridized. It would be, have lots of avoided crossings between F-like and D-like, and like these fat bands, what they look like. So that's not what's done in this case. Something is done. You could just say, well, you choose some atomic orbitals with F character and S and P, and this is the choice of a basis set, and they are, as usual, non-orthogonal, and non this, non that, but you can think of it as a basis set. Now, between these two different viewpoints, here you have done something different.
So right here, what was done first was to chop out 7F.
Chop out what? So you make a choice for each K point.
For each K point, you make a choice. Right. And you form the F one of your functions. So these are not nearly as specifically defined as those lanthanum 422 compound 1EA functions.
No, but it's clear if you make sort of an unsuitable definition, it'll have a lot of tails on
right. And if you would not chop out the F separately.
I think you probably have to choose a band. Do you do this job at every K point?
Every K point.
Yes.
So I'm personally certain that if you would not chop out the Fs and do the Fs and Ds separately, as has been done here, but would do them together, you would get, or you could get, more localized functions because you have more flexibility. Well, most bands are inside the Brillouin zone.
You follow K point by K point to get there, because you need to do the sum of a K point and your Van Leeuwen function.
Right, but no, we haven't followed bands continuously here.
No.
So
if you were following band, then of course the high symmetry points will stick together like this. That will give you a cross, but that will of course give you long range.
So if you would follow the bands, for example, and come down here and include these in the F bands. These, I'm pretty sure there are 7F bands right here at the X point. If you would include these instead of the 7F bands to make F1EA functions, you'd get something very different. So it's picking out 7 here with the most F character. And then it's picking out 5 with the most D character from this region. And then he's gone ahead to pick out and just how dicey this is getting, I can't really tell you. But here, these are the 5D functions. And particularly down here, I think you see 5D with 4F on neighboring atoms. It's primarily 4Fs that they're hybridizing with. And if you like to lower the density and get a better picture, I said we were getting into art here. So a little more of the detail. And then you can look at even higher states. You can run the program for higher states at least, and you get S and 3P functions like this. And if you lower the density, you get things that look more like characters out of Star Wars than anything else. But that's still apparently not very long ranged. And whether, you know, there's numerical questions about just how choosing the bands is done and so forth. But it's not getting even these high conduction states to go over, you know, fifth, sixth neighbors, anything like that. It's all confined.
So these orbitals are a complete set, though. Are you going to show us the bands generated with these orbitals?
No. They're generated from these bands, but
right.
So I can tell you that, not from that figure, but from this one, that the S orbital lies 9.5 eV above the Fermi level, centered 9.5 eV above, and the P 19.
Ron, this is a contraction of your original basis, I guess you. And there must be something which this doesn't get so. I mean, you only get a finite number of bands with this, and they will probably fit where you have fitted or where you pick your A points. But
right.
Not somewhere else.
So you're saying with all these orbitals, one could calculate the Hopping parameters for a finite set of bands, and you would get something which down here looks something like this and would come to an end up there. Right. Yeah. So. No, we haven't done that.
You will have to get that. What else can you get?
Sure. But I mean, this.
But will it look something continuous, or it will jump from here to there?
No, how will it jump? If it's state binding, it's not jump.
Continuous set of bands.
No, if you include all the orbitals, they will be
whatever bands you need to make.
The question is the quality of the fit to the bands. That's where you're questioning all it?
Yeah.
That's one thing. I don't see a clear procedure. I mean, we started out having these Vanier functions being not the.
That's right. I think the procedure here.
Of course, when you get into this overlapping situation and so on, the uniqueness increases.
The procedure here.
The procedure
has to be looked at. Wei ran this because, in our group, we're looking at cerium doing completely different things for other reasons, and so we've been looking at cerium. So he tried chopping out these bands in cerium. So I think that's probably enough time.
So the a message from what you said concerning the previous talk was that they had this anti-ferromagnetism, ferromagnetism, which changes with pressure and whether you put in
neodymium.
And this kind of behavior seems to be captured or given correctly by your calculation, and it seems to come from these tiny, maybe, features of the Vanier function. So your procedure, although these Hopping intervals were tiny and they went up crazy ways, you would never have expected, had you not this calculation, the path by which you were hopping were not so obvious, nevertheless.
Right.
Right.
So there's still quite a bit of uncertainty because we've got the. I think the 1E functions for that compound probably quite good, but the bare U has to be screened, should be screened properly, and in principle one could do something like a constrained density functional calculation varying the occupation of that orbital. It'd probably be quite a chore. And then we have discussions in the group whether this inter-site direct exchange should be screened. I tend to think that's a very secondary point, but That's, it's hard to argue or convince somebody who doesn't believe that.
If you do a negative pressure, say, in the Ethereum system, do you think you get the transition? I mean, the negative transition? Negative pressure means you achieve the lattice farm.
I doubt that we would by the lanthanum lattice constant, just because the chemistry. I think it's really the different chemistry and not the lattice constant that's the main effect here.
No, because when you say things is localized in the copper oxygen.
It would look pretty short when you compress the lanthanum stuff. It doesn't really show the same features.
But the difference is really due to the rare earth site, the lanthanum versus neodymium, and it seems to be due to the difference in chemistry rather than the difference in volume.
Well, okay. Yeah. Let me understand. So this Grignion factor of two. So what you did? So you calculate direct exchange and you calculate super exchange, and you just find that if you somehow multiply super exchange by 1/2, yeah, then you get this difference between these two compounds. So it means that you almost capture all these two different mechanisms of exchange interaction. So one is antiferromagnetic, another is ferromagnetic. So in one compound, so super exchange dominates, and another is direct exchange.
Right. Super exchange along one direction in the neodymium compound.
Yeah. How? But there is another band which locate up and down.
Another band?
Oh, you have bands, yeah, and then you have some gaps, or those spaghetti, and there is also exchange path.
Yes. Yeah, so but that's.
Are you sure that if you include this? Other, but maybe you don't have factor.
Well, in order to get good effective exchange constants, again, I think given the band gap here and so forth, that's
it?
Secondary. I mean, it's also underestimated in it's 3 or 4 EV.
Also, isn't the effect of some of that is built into your one-day functions?
Well, the hybridization of these states, so this is approaching 3 eV, the LDA gap. The hybridization of the rare earth D states and the oxygen P states built in to here. And that hybridization depends on the gap as well as interatomic distance and the separation and energy of those states from the F states and so forth. So we can't be sure that there's not some perturbative corrections.
But then maybe it's just this factor of 2 is a miracle, so it's just shows that it's very good.
Have you done any other compounds to see if the 2 is a miracle or is some systematic thing?
No, but you need to have this such a gap.
Well,
the procedure will work only if you have a huge gap.
In
principle, this is perfectly Anderson idea that first you form some molecular orbital, then you calculate its super exchange and direct exchange.
Let me mention one other compound that we've looked a little bit at, but not in a lot of detail, but things that aren't so clear here. This is lithium 2 copper O2. Look at maybe this structure. There's a copper oxygen chain here, so there's an edge sharing, copper oxygen squares running out of the board here, one here, so it's just a body-centered orthorhombic whatever, and these chains are ferromagnetic chains. All the spins are aligned in the chains, but then they're anti-ferromagnetic. This is a different direction than that. So it's an anti-ferromagnetic material with spins all aligned in the chain, And one thing that we and other people had known before is that the hopping parameter from this copper, effective copper orbital here, which is copper plus oxygens, pi-type oxygen states, the hopping integral is much greater to the second neighbor than to the first because of the way those 1E-like functions overlap. Now, when we and other people figured this out a few years ago, we didn't have 1E functions to look at, but here's what they look like. I guess this is the only picture I have, but it does indeed show the same sort of behavior. This is the copper DXY, the oxygen P's. The next copper is right here. And its oxygen P function sits right through there and is essentially orthogonal to that. Not quite exactly by symmetry, but very close. So the hopping parameter between this copper and this one is just very, very small. And to the second neighbor, where you get this blob overlapping with the blob that comes from this copper, you get the hopping along the chain that way. And then when you look at interchain hopping, you get interchain hopping. So this is not at all one-dimensional system. That's been known before also. And here, it doesn't look like we know, you know, these factors of two and all this. it seems like it doesn't allow us to make a story here for, yeah, you know, there's two. Things are too close. But it's another case where you're getting the same sort of copper oxygen 4 1EA function. And the coupling is in large part being driven by how these pin parts and some of these pieces fit together. The dog is being wagged by the tail. Further questions?